Pierre Goodrich and Benjamin Rogge co-authored a remarkable essay on education entitled Education in a Free Society. In the spirit of that essay, I have just chosen to survey the contemporary scene in higher education. The conclusion of my survey is that higher education is a disaster area in need of draconian reform. Let me begin my case with the following quoted observation. The greatest innovative ideas and initiatives are typically made outside universities. The greater part of universities have not even been very forward to adopt those improvements. Several have chosen to remain the sanctuaries in which exploded systems and obsolete prejudices found shelter and protection after they had been hunted out of every other corner of the world. In general, the richest and best endowed universities have been the slowest in adopting these improvements. The endowments have even diminished the necessity of application in the teachers. Their subsistence is derived from a fund altogether independent of their success and reputation in their particular professions. In the University of Oxford, the greatest part of the public professors have for these many years given up altogether even the pretense of teaching. The author, as so many of you doubtless recognize, is Adam Smith. What he says is as true today as it was in the 18th century. Looked at structurally, the university is a scene of spontaneous disorder and academic license. And I realize that Fred Miller beat me to the punch in first using the expression spontaneous disorder. In theory, governing boards exist to represent the interests of taxpayer citizens in public universities and the original intent of philanthropists in private universities. In practice, the boards of modern universities tend to rubber stamp policy decisions generated by university administrations and faculties. There is little effective external control on the internal authorities that run educational institutions. Because tuition fees are held at artificially low levels in public universities, efficient evaluation of their output is prevented. Because government funding is linked directly to the number of students, university managers divert resources toward enrollment and away from instruction. The result is larger classes, lower admission standards, and less preparation for the classroom by instructors. Given the incentives, there is pressure to extend the allowable time taken to complete a degree. Government funding of private universities has now reached the point where there are virtually no universities that could be described as private. More important, the feudal guild system of academic disciplines operates in both systems so that the same people circulate from one to the other. What we have witnessed is the collapse of the distinction between public and private education. There never was an industry that paid less attention to its customers than the university. It is one in which those who consume its product do not purchase it, those who produce it do not sell it, and those who finance it do not control it. Is there any wonder that faculties offer the sort of product they themselves derive most pleasure in supplying, a product which need not meet the desires or the needs of those for whom it is produced? Now, there are two sources for the current state of degradation. First, the domination of higher education by a faction with a social and political agenda. And second, the addiction to financing education through increased reliance and ultimate dependence upon local, state, and federal governments. These two sources work in tandem because the political agenda construes social life as a series of problems beyond the control of individuals and capable of solution only through a status-controlled social technology. How did all of this come about? Historically, the modern American university emerged in the 19th century from a variety of sources: religious affiliation, local communities, and private benefactors. From the beginning, the university consisted of factions with competing paradigms. The oldest paradigm is moral, as epitomized in Newman, and originated in the small liberal arts college with a religious affiliation. The purpose of liberal education was to preserve knowledge, to pursue knowledge, and to foster a sense of liberty and responsibility. In seeking to subordinate itself to the outside world, the university would only compromise itself and become an instrument for commercial or political exploitation. A second paradigm is the German research model of the university, with its emphasis on the disinterested pursuit of knowledge, the graduate school, and the training of professionals. Knowledge cannot be in the service of special interest groups because knowledge knows no political boundaries. Although non-political, the spectacular success of this model in science and technology encouraged government subvention. The third paradigm is utilitarian, wherein the university is seen as an institution for solving various and sundry social problems. In this model, the university exists as a means to social ends defined externally to the university itself. The notion of the college graduate as a civil servant evolved gradually into the notion of a special class which aims to run society. Now, Newman's moral model of the university has been marginalized. The research model has been corrupted and co-opted, and the politicized utilitarian model has triumphed. The origin of this triumph lies in part in the Enlightenment project. By the Enlightenment project, I mean the view that human nature can be defined and controlled through science and technology. This project originated among a group of 18th century French philosophers, thereby confirming my deep suspicion that all bad ideas come from France. Denying the Christian concept of sin, but still choosing to play God, these philosophers initiated the modern search for a secular utopia. The high priests of the project currently reside largely in the social science departments of major universities, and these high priests are further charged to enlist students in the cause of supporting political candidates who advocate the project of social technology. Doctrinaire liberalism is simply the current version of the Enlightenment project. It has an agenda that can be summarized in terms of 10 commandments, and you can preface all of these with "thou shalt believe." So commandment number one, thou shalt believe that individuals are fundamentally good and corrupted only by their environment. Two, the nation state, especially the United States, is an outmoded institution. Three, the use of military force is always bad. Four, crime cannot be handled by police and prisons, but requires greater economic and social equality. Five, the major institutions of American society, the firm, the school, the church, the family, are passé. Six, there is little value left in traditional American political, economic, and social traditions, such as private ownership, federalism, individual rights, or local control. Seven, efficiency and excellence are excuses for racial, ethnic, and sexual discrimination. Eight, the state is to oversee delivery of all services and is to be staffed by liberal law school graduates. Nine, equality before the law and equality of opportunity are to be replaced by equality of result. And 10, environments are threatened only by free market economies. Now, many parents spend well over $100,000 to have these commandments taught to their children. The entrenchment of this doctrinaire liberalism has spawned affirmative action, the elimination of the humanities in favor of the social sciences, and the undermining of the ability of students to think critically. First, affirmative action. This is not what it appears to be. It is not simply or even the hiring and promoting of people by proportion in the population. It is the hiring and promoting of people who support the agenda of doctrinaire liberalism. And I would not be surprised soon to see announcements in professional journals which say things like conservative women, African Americans, and Hispanics need not apply. And to give one example of this, it's a kind of example that you can't invent because reality is always more bizarre than anything we can think of. In my previous university, the City University of New York, I used to attend a weekly luncheon sponsored by the Political Science Association. And I was there for two reasons. First, I was their token conservative. And second, I will go anywhere for a free lunch. At one of these meetings, we were told that a new chair was being established at the City University in political science, and we were asked to suggest potential candidates. And being in a somewhat whimsical mood, I suggested that we think of Margaret Thatcher, since she had just recently stepped down as British Prime Minister. Now, my colleagues took me seriously, That is, they did this because in their paranoia, they believe that all conservatives are part of a secret and powerful organization, and that we all have access to each other and the levers of power. Of course, I've never even met Margaret Thatcher. The following week, Personnel Committee came back, and I, of course, had completely forgot about my suggestion. And they announced at the beginning of the meeting that Margaret Thatcher would not be considered as a potential candidate. She does not have a PhD in political science. What could she possibly know about politics? A further consequence of affirmative action is the growth of programs of class, race, and gender studies. Creation of these programs means hiring people able and willing to teach Frantz Fanon or Michel Foucault, as opposed to, say, St. Augustine or Thomas Hobbes. Invariably, those willing to teach Fanon or Foucault subscribe to doctrinaire liberalism, or even worse. These programs and curricular changes are intended to influence the trajectory of hiring and scholarship. Second, we have the subversion of the humanities. Very briefly, let me explain what is going on here intellectually. In legitimate, hard scientific thinking, we speculate on the hidden structure behind how things appear on the surface. If successful, we replace our ordinary understanding by appeal to previously hidden structures. So the discovery of atoms, viruses, genes, etc., would be examples. In humanistic thinking, we try to clarify our ordinary understanding of our practices in the hope of extracting from that practice a set of norms that can be used reflectively to guide future practice. We do not change or replace our ordinary understanding, but rather come to know it in a new and better way. And that is why Plato, Shakespeare, and T.S. Eliot are perennially relevant to us. What has happened is that pseudo-social science has replaced the humanities. In addition to denying us access to the illumination of the human predicament that comes from the Judeo-Christian tradition, pseudo-social science has also sought to replace our humanistic image of ourselves with a pseudo-scientific image. Two things result from this: the denigration of core curricula, which provide students, or used to provide students, with the fundamental concepts by which we come to understand who we are, and two, the substitution of speculative hypotheses about the alleged underlying causes of our corrupt values. Third, the kind of thinking stressed in the pseudo-social sciences is responsible for the demise of critical thinking. Unlike legitimate physical science, the alleged hidden structures to which pseudo-social science appeals never get confirmed empirically. What we get is a kind of endless series of faddish languages, one replacing the other. In the presence of competing theories of hidden structures, and with no way to choose among them, pseudo-social science resorts to the following technique, namely more of the same. Instead of refuting alternative views, they speculate on the hidden structure behind the alternative views. That is, they speculate on why their adversaries hold what they take to be false views. In short, they give hidden structure accounts of alternative views of hidden structures. The end result is that instead of honest intellectual dialogue, they dismiss their opponents as victims of some hidden force. It is much easier to call your opponent a racist or a sexist than to answer objections about the incoherence of affirmative action. Ironically, the positivist model of the disinterested pursuit of knowledge has been a major accomplice in all this. Forgetting that science rests upon values that science itself cannot justify, positivism proceeded to delegitimate the religious and metaphysical foundations of Western civilization. Unable to provide any moral content of its own, it eventually falls prey to the relativism and nihilism of the counterculture. Its last gasp is to demand academic freedom, although it no longer knows what freedom means. To sum up, doctrinaire liberalism has changed the intellectual climate on campus. It has undermined the capacity for humanistic self-appraisal. It has condoned an atmosphere that refuses to engage in honest self-criticism and self-examination, and it has undermined genuine academic freedom, and it has cheated our students. What is to be done? let me make 10 recommendations. This is my last list of 10 for the day. One, the main issue is whether we need a specific major institution focused on the explication of our fundamental values. My suggestion is that we do not, and that it is a great danger to have just one. The explication of our fundamental values should be part of every institution. Experience shows that the family, the church, the independent school, and private philanthropy are best equipped to handle this function. Hence, any public policy that undermines the autonomy of these institutions is to be resisted. Second, since private enterprise is one of our fundamental values, we should live up to it and instantiate it in education. I urge the complete privatization of schooling at every level. Third, specifically, I urge the removal of government, both federal, state, and local, from higher education. This removal should take the form of eliminating subsidies, student loans, and contracts for the performance of any government-sponsored research. We should distinguish and separate from higher education all commercial, scientific, and technological research. These are very important functions, but all of these important functions are best and more efficiently left to private research institutes. Five, we should distinguish occupational training from higher education, and the former removed from the incompetent hands of so-called professional educators. Six, we should distinguish longer education, that is, additional training necessitated beyond the 12th grade by a rapidly changing and evolving work environment, from higher education. Seven, we should eliminate all government-sponsored accrediting agencies. Eight, we should eliminate tenure. Nine, we should explore alternative forms of education made possible by the new technology, giving us the capacity to create on a macro-cultural level a virtual university and the invisible college that Pierre Goodrich's Liberty Fund embodies on the micro-cultural level. And 10, we should bring a class action suit against institutions of higher education for failure to live up to their promises, for misrepresentation, for false and misleading advertising, and for undermining Western civilization. Thank you.